We're both skinny. And when no one said anything, he shrugged and climbed into the car on the other side of me. Raphael stood looking at the people in the spaces as if the whole thing were an elaborate puzzle that he could solve if only he could find the right piece. "This is ridiculous," Celia finally said. "Maribel, would you mind sitting on Mayor's lap? It's only for a few miles. I'll sit in the front, and Rafa, you drive." Silently, Maribel walked around the car and climbed in on top of Mayor. The rhinestone butterflies in the back pockets of her jeans resting on his thighs. Arturo looked at me. "It's okay," I said, even though I was worried too about letting her ride like this. Here the road seemed clear, but what if farther on they were still icy? I reached over and locked Mayor's door. I clutched Maribel's forearm as if somehow that would protect her in the case of an accident. Rafael had to rev the engine a few times to get it to start in the cold. And just after it did, someone called from the balcony. Rafael cranked the window down.
"Is everything all right?"
I heard a voice yell, "Quisqueya," she said.
"I heard some commotion, so I came out to check."
"We're fine," Rafael shouted back. Quisqueya bent down to peer between the balcony bars.
"Who's there?"
"It's the Riveras and us," Rafa called. "We're headed to the park to take the kids skating." I caught a glimpse of her face, which betrayed disappointment mixed with a flash of envy. Rafael said,
"Celia will call you later,"
and I saw Quisqueya give him a doubtful look as he raised the window.
"I don't need—"
she started to say, but the window closed before she finished.
"Why did you tell her I would call her later?" Celia asked.
"Just to get her off our back. What does she care what we're doing? But now I have to call her later." Rafael put the car in reverse. "Vida ajena, that woman," he said.
"What does that mean?" Mayor asked.
"A nosy person," Rafael said. "Always interfering." He started to pull out.
"Okay, enough of this. If we wait much longer, the ice is going to melt. Vámonos."
There must have been 100 children at the marsh. As we walked toward the frozen pond, we saw them flailing their arms and squealing as they cast their bodies across the surface, half squatting to steady themselves.
"Will it break?" I asked, "with all those children on top of it?"
"I don't know how it works," Arturo said. We walked over the brittle grass, and when we came to the pond, Maribel crouched down and laid her hand against the surface.
"You can skate on it," Celia said. "See all the kids?"
"Go ahead," Arturo said. "Let's see if you can stand on ice. That's not something any of your friends in Pátzcuaro can say." We all waited for her to do something, but Maribel simply squatted with her feet rooted to the ground, staring back at us through her sunglasses.
"Come on, Maribel," I said.
I meant to sound encouraging, but it came out shrill. Arturo glared at me, and I looked away from him, embarrassed by my impatience.
"Don't you want to try it?" Mayor asked.
He jumped onto the ice and slid with his arms out to the sides.
"See? It's fun."
Maribel stood and took a step toward the ice, and Mayor hurried back to help her down. He walked slowly, pulling her along. I held my breath, watching her every step, worried that she might fall. But she was walking on her own before long, one foot carefully in front of the other. And I looked at Arturo and smiled.
"She's doing it," I said.
Rafael and Celia glided out into the middle of the pond together, and cautiously, with his hands in his coat pockets, Arturo stepped onto the ice and twisted his boots in small Zs, staring at his feet.
"How does it feel?" I asked, It's like a floor, he said. Come, try it.
Arturo skated backwards on the soles of his boots, looking over his shoulder as he moved to make sure he wasn't about to bump into anyone. I stood on the bank of the marsh and watched him, the way he wobbled and twitched. And then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something. I jerked my head around. The boy, I thought. But when I turned, no one was there. Had he been there? I felt sure of it all of a sudden, sure that he was watching us, waiting for his chance. I looked back to where Maribel had been standing with Mayor, but I didn't see her. I didn't see her or Mayor. I scanned the marsh, raking my eyes through all the bodies moving across the ice, the children in their bright coats and wool hats, shrieking and laughing. Maribel, I said out loud. Mari! The next thing I knew, Arturo was in front of me again at the edge of the bank.
What's wrong? He asked.
Where did she go? I said. Maribel!
Arturo whipped around. Ma!
He began to shout. Then he stopped. She's right there, Alma. She's standing with Mayor. I tried to focus on where he was pointing.
I don't see her. She's right there.
Then, her dark hair, her thin, coltish legs and her slim jeans, her big coat. I blinked and took a long breath, trying to loosen the fist around my heart. I didn't see her, I said. Arturo shook his head.
I don't know what's going on with you.
I lost track of her. Arturo stepped off the ice and onto the bank where I was.
No, he said. It's something else.
I don't just mean now. And for one compact second, for no real reason, I considered telling him about the boy. It was nothing more than a block of words, I thought, that I could hand him like a gift. But what would he think of me now, knowing that I'd been keeping so much from him for so long? The boy coming to the apartment. Me going to Capitol Oaks, finding the boy with Maribel that day. Besides, before we left Mexico, I had promised him I would handle everything here. I had promised myself I wouldn't burden him with one more thing. And now here it was. One more thing. It's nothing, I said.
You're lying.
I shook my head, afraid to open my mouth.
So it's just my imagination, then. Am I going crazy?
You're not going crazy.
So there is something.
It's just the usual things. You being out of work and the money. Maybe I'm homesick.
That's not it, he said.
I don't know what you want me to say.
I want you to tell me the truth.
I am telling you the truth.
Come on, Alma. You think I don't know you? You think I don't breathe you and dream you every single day of my life? You think I haven't been inside you? I know when you're lying to me. There's something else.
And again, for the briefest moment, I thought. How easy it would be to say, here. I've been holding on to this all this time, but here. If you want it, you can have it. When I look back on it now, I see that I should have done it. In that split second, telling him might have changed our fates. There's nothing else, I said. I gazed out across the pond, to the tree line and the soft wash of sky. I kept my eyes on Maribel, watching her with Mayor, the way she smiled when she was with him. The way he talked to her without judgment or expectation, how at ease she seemed when he was around. I was grateful for those things. Look at her, I said. Arturo turned, and together we watched as Maribel drew out a strand of hair that had blown into her mouth. Mayor said something, and she laughed. Arturo walked to the edge of the frozen grass and stepped onto the ice again, tapping his boots against its marbled surface. He looked at me with a gentle expression.
"Come on," he said, offering his hand. I didn't move.
"I'm here," he said. "Whenever you're ready." I took his hand, feeling his rough, warm skin against mine.
"I'm right here," he said.
I lowered one foot onto the ice.
He tugged gently,
walking his fingers up to my elbows, easing me down. I picked up my other foot and planted it next to the first as I clung to Arturo's coat sleeves. And then I was standing on the ice, which I was astonished to find felt as firm as the ground. All of me braced in Arturo's arms. The Sunday after we went skating, Arturo asked to borrow the Torres' radio, and we took it home with us after eating lunch at their apartment. Arturo set it on the kitchen table and tuned it to a station playing nothing but the Beatles, which had been his favorite band since he was a boy. He raised the volume and sang along with the words he had memorized from a lifetime of listening. La, 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 life goes on. Smiling wide and clapping. "Va!" he shouted sometimes at me or at Maribel. And he drummed his hands on the table, on the walls, on our rear ends. The Beatles sang in their English accents about the sun coming out after the winter. We sang along even though we didn't know what some of the words meant. "Little darling, it's all right." And then, in the middle of the revelry, we heard a knock at the door.
"What was that?" Arturo asked.
"What?" I asked.
A knock sounded again.
Arturo walked past me to the door, and when he returned, he was trailed by Quisqueya.
"Alma," she said when she saw me. "Buenas."
"Quisqueya says she needs to talk to us," Arturo said.
"Have a seat. Can I get you something? Water?
Do you have coffee?"
I started to shake my head. We had bought neither coffee nor tea in weeks. But then she said,
"Oh, don't go to any trouble on my behalf. I mean, if you have some made."
She craned her neck to scan the countertop for evidence of a coffee pot, while she lowered herself into an empty chair.
"I'll get you water," I said.
If it had been anyone else, I would have been embarrassed by not having something more to offer. But there was something strangely pleasurable about having to disappoint someone like Quisqueya.
"Only if it's not too much trouble," Quisqueya said, folding her small hands in her lap.
I took a glass from the cabinet and turned on the tap.
"Maribel, come, say hello,"
Arturo instructed, turning off the music and summoning her from the living room. Dutifully, Maribel walked over, tucking her hair behind her ears.
"Say hello," Arturo urged.
Maribel stayed quiet.
"It's fine," Quisqueya said. "I understand."
Arturo tightened his jaw.
"She's shy," he said.
"Maribel, we need to talk to Quisqueya for a few minutes. Do you want to wait in the bedroom?" I asked. After she left, Arturo settled himself across from Quisqueya at the kitchen table. I placed the glass of water in front of her. She took a sip and pushed it to the middle of the table. Then she sat, squeezing her fingers in her lap. Arturo raised his eyebrows at me. I shook my head as puzzled as him.
"Well," Quisqueya began, "I hate to say anything."
"Is everything all right?" I asked.
"With me? I'm fine. Thank you for asking."
She fidgeted while Arturo and I waited.
"Well," she began again, "I was on my way out to the hospital one afternoon.
Did you know that I volunteer there? It's nothing, really. I change bedpans and prop up pillows and deliver lunches. Sometimes the patients mistake me for a nurse, but I tell them, please, nurses do important work. I simply come and do chores. It's nothing. Of course, we are all doing God's work. That's what I think, even if we contribute in only small ways. She stopped and looked at us.
What you do is important, I offered, even though I didn't know where this was headed.
Yes, Kiske agreed. She reached for the water glass again, but thought better of it and drew her hand back to her lap.
I was on my way out a few weeks ago, and you know that the Toros got a car. I haven't had a chance yet to ride in it myself, but...
Ah, of course, you know. They took you for a drive, didn't they? Last week?
Did you see me? On the balcony?
Rafael can be so rude sometimes.
And do you know that Celia never called me after that?
I hardly see her anymore. It seems she always has plans with other people. And here...
Quisqueya looked pointedly at me.
So there's never really a good time to catch her anymore. It's such a shame. She and I used to be very close.
Artur looked at me, confused.
I saw them sitting in the car together, Quisqueya said suddenly.
Who? Artur asked.
Mayor Toro and your daughter. They were together in the car.
Quisqueya cast a quick glance down the hallway, then leaned toward us.
They were kissing, she said.
When? I asked.
It was a few weeks ago.
Kissing, Arturo said?
Yes, they were kissing.
Mayor Toro and your daughter, Maribel.
You sure it was them? Arturo asked.
I'm positive. In Rafael's car.
When had they been in Rafael's car? They knew the rule. They had to be here or at the Toros' apartment.
They spent a lot of time together, Quisqueya said.
They're friends, Arturo said. I could tell he was upset, but he didn't want to give Quisqueya the satisfaction of knowing it.
I think they're more than friends.
Okay, Arturo said. Is that what you came here to tell us? Quisqueya looked momentarily defeated. I could see it in her face. She had been eager to deliver this news. She had been looking forward to see what impact it would make. And now that she saw that it hardly left a dent, she was disappointed.
No, she said slowly. There's more.
When she didn't offer anything else sitting there with her mouth pinched, Arturo said,
And? What is it?
It only started with a kiss, Quisqueya said.
But then Mayor put his hand on her leg. I could see them through the windshield.
They were kissing, and then Mayor leaned toward her, and he put his hand on her leg. And it was hard to see everything they were doing, but a few minutes later, when Mayor stepped out of the car, his pants were wet.
Arturo pushed himself back from the table and stood. Quisqueya stopped talking, her eyes wide, her face nearly as red as her hair.
I didn't know what to think. It was too much.
You're making this up, Arturo said.
I'm sorry, Quisqueya said, but I thought you should know.
Especially considering...
Arturo, sit down, I said.
He was pacing in small circles.
I know how boys can be, Quisqueya said.
Boys Mayor's age, you can't be too careful.
Of course, Seiya always tells me he's so good.
But I was over there recently, and you should have heard how he talked to me
Very disrespectful. If that's how he treats me, I started to think, well, I was worried about Maribel.
Arturo looked at me as if to ask,
do you believe her?
I don't know, I told him with my eyes. Maybe. I wasn't sure.
But I wasn't ready to take any chances either, if there was even a possibility.
I should go now, Quisqueya said. Thank you for the water. She waited as if she expected one of us to escort her to the door. When neither Arturo nor I moved, Quisqueya walked out herself, the click of her shoes echoing down the hall.
Mayor. Late in February, my dad came home from work one night and said, it's over. I was on my way to the kitchen, but I knew enough to tell when I should stay out of his way. A few years ago, Enrique and I had devised an alert system where we'd hold up a certain number of fingers to each other to indicate how far up the scale of volatility my dad was. If Enrique had been there that day, I would have rated this a level 4, the second highest possible, which meant radioactive, steer clear. The day he'd grounded me had probably been a level 6, off the charts. From the hallway, I listened as my mom scurried out to meet him. I heard muffled voices, and then, for a long minute, I heard nothing. Mayor, come to dinner, my mom called. She sounded angry. I walked down the hall slowly, unsure about what to expect, preparing myself to be yelled at again. Maybe I'd messed up something in the car when I snuck in there with Maribel, and he'd just now noticed. But my dad had been in the car since then. All of us had gone to White Clay to skate on the marsh the week before, and he hadn't said anything. Or maybe Señora Rivera finally said something to my mom about how I'd been over there when I wasn't supposed to be. Or maybe anything. You never knew with my dad. But when I got to the table, he didn't say a word. He was sitting with his arms crossed, still wearing his coat and knit cap, while my mom dumped arroz con guandu onto plates, knocking the side of the spoon against the paila with each motion. I didn't say anything either. I just concentrated on being invisible, lowering myself quietly into a chair, holding my breath. When she had finished half the food on her plate, my mom looked at my dad and said, aren't you going to tell him? Leave it alone, Celia. He deserves to know, doesn't he? Know what? I asked. Go to your room, my dad said. What did I do? That's how you answer me? When I say go to your room, you go. Mayor, stay where you are, my mom said. He hasn't eaten yet, Rafa. Let him eat. Mayor, go to your room, my dad said again. Mayor, stay where you are, my mom said. I waited for my dad to counter, and when he didn't, I hesitantly picked up my fork and poked it into my rice. I took a few bites while my parents watched me. My mom was curling and uncurling her lips like she wanted to say something. A geyser waiting to spew. After a minute and 22 seconds, I watched the time tick by on the clock on the wall. My mom said, well, what if you don't find anything? Jesus, Celia! I think it's a legitimate question. I've already told you I'll find something. But what if it's not for a while? Then it's not for a while. Rafa! This woman! My dad said, looking up at the ceiling and pressing his hands together like he was praying. Que Dios me ayude! Don't say that. You don't listen to me. You're not telling me anything. I'm telling you I'll find something. Do you want me to say it again? I'll find something. I'll find something. Do you hear me? After my dad left the table, snatching his pack of cigarettes from on top of the refrigerator and escaping to the balcony, my mom looked at me and said, well, I guess you might as well know. It finally happened. Your father lost his job. The rest of the story emerged little by little. The diner was closing. Windows boarded up, doors locked, out of business after 45 years. All that time, my dad had spent worrying that he was going to get fired for dropping an omelet or for leaving the freezer door open, and now the reason he'd been axed wasn't even his fault. It was the rotten economy that had landed him in the water, and that had capsized the whole ship along with him. For 15 years, my dad had been working at that diner. 15 years of taking the bus to the same place with leatherette booths and a coffee-stained linoleum counter and wood-paneled walls. He'd started as a busboy, clearing tables and wiping up bits of egg that had been left behind on the tables, and he'd never complained. "I wouldn't have done much better in Panama," I'd heard him say before. "I didn't have the brains to make much of myself." My dad was smart, though. He'd never gone to college, which gave him the wrong idea about himself. But the only reason he hadn't was because he'd been forced into getting a job after his parents died. He'd waited tables at a roadside restaurant in Panama, which turned out to be the only experience he needed to find work in the United States. Eventually, my dad worked his way up from busboy to dishwasher to line cook. He flipped thousands of omelets and fried mountains of hash browns. He strained the pulp from the orange juice by hand when they used to do that sort of thing, and then dispensed prefab OJ from a machine when the management switched to that. He remembered the days when everyone who came in ordered coffee and remembered how the waitresses had complained when everyone started asking for lattes instead. 15 years. 6 days a week. Early mornings. Up to his elbows in grease. And now it was over. Just like that. My dad scoured the newspaper every day, searching the classifieds, calling any that sounded promising, and hanging up either in fury or in disappointment. He went all over town, filling out applications to work in the kitchens at the Christiana Hilton, Cafe Gelato, Valet Pizza, Grotto Pizza, Friendly's, Charcoal Pit, Alibaba, Klondike Kate's, Iron Hill, Homegrown, the Deer Park, and even the restaurant at the Hotel DuPont. My mom suggested he go to the community house to see if someone there could help him, but he hated the idea of it so much, either of my mom interfering or of accepting help from a place that he called the handout house, that he shouted at her to keep her big nose out of it, to which my mom said, "Big nose?" To which my dad replied by holding his arm in front of his face to mimic an elephant. My mom didn't even have a big nose, but the two of them were down to cheap shots by then, and my mom ran to the bedroom, where she shut herself away all afternoon. Even when my parents were speaking civilly to one another, they spent the dinner hour complaining about how so far President Obama hadn't done anything, and how they saw absolutely zero improvements, and about how people were getting desperate, and thank God we had the money from Gloria, but everyone else was in a tough spot, and it had gotten so bad now that people were getting mugged outside of Western Unions for the money they were about to wire to relatives back home. "They're targeting people who look like us," my dad said. "It used to be the Orientals, but the style now is to pick on the Latinos. And the Arabs, at least them I can understand, they did September 11th. What did we ever do to anyone?" My dad looked at my mom and me like he honestly expected someone to give him an answer. "Oriental is for rugs," I said, repeating something that my social studies teacher, Mr. Perry, had told us once.
"What?"
"You're supposed to say Asians, not Orientals. I don't know if Arab is right either."
"This is what they teach you in school?" my dad said. "Forget about what to call people. What about the history?"
"They teach us history."
"And has it ever been this bad before in the history of this country?"
"Well, there was the Great Depression."
"I don't know," my dad said. "It seems to me like the world is going to hell."
"Don't say that," my mom said.
"What would you prefer I say?"
"How about something nice for a change?"
"I say nice things."
"When?" My dad shrugged.
"Exactly," my mom said.
I hadn't hung out with William in months. lately because I'd been grounded. But even before that, there had been times when he'd invited me to do something. Go to Holy Angels to watch the girls in their uniforms, or to Bing's to get cinnamon rolls, or to a movie at Newark Shopping Center. But I'd shot him down so often that he started snubbing me, acting like he didn't see me when I passed him in the hall at school, walking away if I approached him at his locker, sitting at a table as far from me as he could possibly get in the cafeteria. I figured that, with enough time, he would get over it. But in the end, I was the one who caved. "Hey," I said one day in chemistry. We were going through the motions of that day's experiment, sitting side by side while neither of us acknowledged the other's existence. "Is this seriously how it's going to be?" He pretended like he couldn't hear me. "Hey," I said louder. He looked at me. "You know this is dumb, right?" I said. "Did you just call me dumb?" I rolled my eyes. "So you're going to keep being like this?" "Like what?" "Like, not my friend." "Me? You're the one who keeps dissing." "I've been grounded."
"So you said."
"It's true."
"What about before that?"
"I had other plans."
"Yeah, with her."
"I told you that you could come hang out with us if you wanted."
"What do you do with her anyway?"
"What do you mean? We talk."
"She can talk?" I gave him the finger. William pulled a beaker out of the clamp and held it up to the light, watching the soft fizz of the chemicals inside.
"What do you want me to say?" I asked.
"So you're sorry."
"For what?"
He gave me a sideways look. "Seriously, if you don't know, then it's not worth it." I ran my tongue along my teeth. "Fine, if that's what it took."
"Sorry," I said.
"Like you mean it."
"You're being a jackass," I said.
William shrugged.
"Sorry," I said again. He grinned and put the beaker down.
"So, amigo, you want to do something after school today?"
"I'm still grounded."
"Fuck that. We just made up. You can't leave me hanging now. We'll go see a movie or something. I'll drive you home after."
I could see how much it meant to him and how crushed he would be if I turned him down. Besides, I'd snuck out that time to see Maribel and had gotten away with it, so maybe I could pull it off again.
"Sure," I told William. "No problem."
The second I got home that day, my mom stood up from the couch and said, "Señora Rivera called me." That was it. Nothing about where I had been or why I was so late getting home. Nothing about my grounding. I put my backpack on the floor. My mom frowned. She was twisting a bracelet around her wrist.
"Why?"
I asked.
"Was it Maribel?"
I wondered all of a sudden. Had something happened to her? My mom looked like she was about to say something, but then she stopped herself.
"We should probably wait for your father."
"But why?"
"We should talk to you together."
Now I was really worried. "Can't you just tell me now? Is something wrong?" My mom searched my face. Her eyes were heavy and tired, and the makeup around them was smudged, like she'd been rubbing at them.
"I don't know," she said.
"Is Maribel okay?"
"Maybe you should go to your room, Mayor."
"Is she okay?"
"Please, Mayor, don't make me say anything right now. I don't even know what to say. Just wait until your father gets home. He and I need to talk first, and then we'll come find you."
"I'm just asking you if she's okay." That was all I wanted to know. As long as she was okay, I thought, nothing else my mom could say would matter.
"She's fine," my mom said. "Just..."
She started, when behind me, my dad walked in the front door. He took one look at my mom and said,
"What?"
"I need to talk to you," she said.
"What happened?"
"Mayor, go to your room. We'll come see you in a minute."
"Bobby's home now. Why can't I just stay here?"
"Mayor, please," my mom said. My dad cast his gaze at me.
"You heard her," he said. "Go."
Angrily, I dragged my backpack across the carpet toward my room. Pick it up, my mom screamed. Without turning around, I snatched it off the floor and went to my room. I heard my dad say, Celia, what the hell? Before I shut the door. I sat on my unmade bed with my elbows on my knees. I got up and kicked my shoes off into the corner. I tried to listen through the door, but I couldn't hear anything. From my pants pocket, my phone vibrated, and when I checked it, William had sent me a text. Good movie. Your mom mad? I wrote back. Don't know. Sent me to my room. William. Ha ha, pussy. Me. T-T-Y-L. I turned off my phone and threw it on my dresser. After an eternity, my parents knocked on my door and came in. I could see right away that my mom had been crying. She was clutching a used tissue in one hand, and she stood with her body half hidden behind my dad, who had a dark look in his eyes. I stood in my socks, facing them, waiting for the news, whatever it was. We received a call, my dad said, his voice stony. I already told him that part, my mom said. My dad raised his hand to silence her. Señora Rivera said that you and Maribel were in my car the other day. I gulped. We didn't do anything to it. So it's true? I nodded. Is it my imagination? My dad asked. Or are you still grounded? Yes. How did you get the keys? My mom asked. I took them off the windowsill. My dad looked at me evenly. Did you kiss Maribel? He asked. Flames shot through my cheeks. What? Did you kiss her in the car? Why? Answer the question, Mayor. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe yes or maybe no. I just stared at them. What did you do with her? Nothing. Did you kiss her? My mom asked from behind my dad. I mean, yeah, I guess. It wasn't a big deal. My dad glanced at my mom, and for one delirious second I thought I was off the hook, that somehow I'd exonerated myself and that we could all just go back to business as usual. But then my dad said to me, slowly, gravely, You are not going to see her anymore.
What?
No more.
But what does that mean?
It means exactly what I said. I felt a dullness in my chest.
But why?
Her parents don't want you to see her, my dad said.
Because I kissed her?
Was there more?
I mean, no. No? My mom asked, hopefully. I swear there wasn't.
But my dad shook his head. It doesn't matter. You broke the rules, Mayor. You're only supposed to be with her in one of our apartments, aren't you? I know you might think that's unfair, but that's what the Riveras want for her, so you have to respect it. And on top of that, you're still grounded, which means you shouldn't have seen her no matter where you were.
This is because you don't like her, I said.
No, you never liked her.
Mayor, calm down, my mom said. You don't even know anything about her. I mean, did anyone even ask her what she wants?
My dad shook his head. You're not going to see her again.
So that's it? I said.
I felt the whole thing reeling away from me, like a rope slipping through my hands.
Dios, my mom said. Qué lío magnífico.
José Mercado. My wife Inés and I were both brought into the world by way of Puerto Rico, me in 1950 and she 5 years later. Not long after we were married, I enlisted in the Navy. I always wanted to do something heroic. With the Navy, I traveled to Vietnam, Grenada, the Persian Gulf, and Bosnia. I was injured in Bosnia, which requires me to use a walker now. But I came home. I came home. And that is all any soldier cares about. I love the esoteric things in life. My father used to call me an esthete. He meant it not as a compliment, of course. He was disappointed by my interests and by the fact that they were not the same as his, which were farming and raising livestock. He believed a man should work hard with his hands, that toil and sweat were evidence of a virtuous life. He did not appreciate that I wanted to read books, and that I saved money to buy an easel when I turned 15, and that I would spend the afternoons painting pictures of trees. The only time he was proud of me, in fact, was when I joined the Navy. He was an old man by then, nearing death, but I still remember his face when I told him. The way he had smiled with those teeth of his that were brown around the edges, the way the wrinkles rippled up to the surface of his cheeks. Inez was not as happy about it. She supported me, but she was worried. We never had children. We knew from the outset and in a terribly selfish way that our interest lay only in each other. So when she was home during my deployments, she was there alone, and the weight of the solitude depressed her, I think, and gave her wide open plains upon which her mind would wander, allowing her too much time and space to think about what might be happening to me, as well as whether and when I would return. When I came back from Vietnam, she wept at my feet. I saw clearly the toll it had taken on her, but I wasn't ready to leave the Navy. I had witnessed the sort of atrocities during the war that threatened to steal a man's soul. I saw that humans are no better than any animal or brute, and in many cases might be infinitely worse. But often in the span of the same day, I would be restored, too, by the courage of men. And I had come to understand my father's perspective about the gratification of feeling useful, of being in the world under the most demanding circumstances, and learning that I could not only survive, but thrive, and that my body, the physical presence of me, could have import. So 8 years later, I left again. But this time while I was away, I wrote Inez letters. If she heard from me with enough regularity, I thought, it would ease her worry. Over the years, over the subsequent deployments, I sent her hundreds of letters. I wrote two or three a day sometimes. They began as a way to save her, but they saved me also. They helped me to make sense of the things I saw, and from that, I began to make sense of the world and my place within it. I read a lot of poetry in those days. I took small chapbooks overseas with me, chapbooks bound by staples with covers that were little more than construction paper. I copied the poems down sometimes and included them in my letters. Inez used to tell me I should write my own poetry. But just because you have the requisite admiration and even ambition to do something doesn't mean you're up to the task of performing it yourself, which was the case for me. I am good at being a reader of poetry, but not at much beyond that. My eyes have turned against me now, so I am resigned to listening to books on CD. Sometimes Inez reads poetry aloud to me. I no longer have any of those chapbooks that used to keep me company in so many far-flung places. I usually burn them after I finish them, just to lighten my load. But Inez borrows books from the library, and we sit on the couch, and she covers me with an afghan and draws her slender feet up onto the cushions, and I close my eyes while she reads. There's an American poet named Marvin Bell who emerged in the late 60s, during the height of the Vietnam War. He has a beautiful poem called Poem After Carlos Dumont de Andrade, which is a reference to the great Brazilian poet. I love the part that goes, "And it's life, just life, that makes you breathe deeply in the air that is filled with wood smoke and the dust of the factory, because you hurried, and now your lungs heave and fall with the nervous excitement of a leaf in spring breezes, though it is winter, and you are swallowing the dirt of the town." And then this portion at the end, which means everything to me. "Life got its tentacles around you, its hooks into your heart, and suddenly you come awake as if for the first time, and you are standing in a part of the town where the air is sweet, your face flushed, your chest thumping, your stomach a planet, your heart a planet, your every organ a separate planet, all of it of a piece, though the pieces turn separately. Oh, silent indications of the inevitable, as among the natural restraints of winter and good sense, life blows you apart in her arms.
Alma. After we told her that she couldn't see Mayor anymore, Maribel grew moody and sullen. I had witnessed a hint of the same thing ever since Mayor had been grounded, but now it was worse. She hardly spoke. She nodded or shook her head. She held out her hand to indicate that she wanted something. She sat on the ledge at the front window and stared across the parking lot with her chin planted on her knees. Once, nearly 2 years ago, Maribel had insisted on painting her fingernails black. She and her friend Abelina hid away in her room and painted each other's nails. And when Maribel came to the dinner table that night, we saw it.
"What did you do to your hands?" Arturo asked.
"I painted my nails," Maribel said, grinning and holding her fingers out like a fan.
"Is it permanent?" Arturo asked.
"It's just nail polish, papi." Arturo looked at me as if to ask, "Is this something we should be worried about?" I had learned by then that Maribel liked to think of herself as a rebel. And yet she managed only small insurrections. She stayed out too late with her friends. She walked through the middle of the boys' soccer games in the street, impervious to their shouts for her to get out of the way. She painted her fingernails black. And she did it all playfully, good-naturedly, in a way that made it impossible to be angry at her. At the dinner table, she wiggled her fingers in the air and said, "I think it looks cool." Arturo glanced at me again. This time Maribel saw him. "What?" she said. "It's okay to be different." "Of course it is," I said. With a depth of feeling that was lost on her, Arturo said, "We would love you no matter what, because you're ours." Maribel tucked a bite of her cuernillo relleno inside her cheek until it bulged. She chewed loudly, smacking her tongue against the roof of her mouth. "Would you love me if I ate like this all the time?" she asked. I watched Arturo fight a smile. "Yes," he said. Maribel swallowed and curled her lips back with her fingers. "What if I look like this?" Arturo grinned. "Yes." She tensed the muscles in her neck until every tendon rose to the surface beneath her skin, like strings under a drooping tent. "What if I walked around looking like this all the time?" "Maribel, stop it," I said. Arturo looked right at her, struggling to keep a straight face. "No matter what," he said. It was still the truth, but the way she was acting now had me worried. She had been showing so much improvement. The latest report from the school had said that Maribel could easily answer questions and follow prompts, and that her attention span had increased. And I hoped we hadn't just undermined all of her progress. "Do you think we did the right thing?" I whispered to Arturo one night when I couldn't sleep. I shoved him awake and said it again.
"What?" he asked.
"About Mayor and Maribel. Do you think we did the right thing?" "It's the middle of the night, Alma," Arturo said. I glanced to where Maribel lay, curled up in the sleeping bag, her hair spread like a veil over her face. Then I turned back to Arturo. "It seems like it's only made things worse." Arturo rubbed his eyes.
"We've talked about this already.
You heard what Quisqueya said. We don't even know if she was telling the truth. Mayor admitted to his parents that they were in the car together. You're the one who was so upset about that part of it. He knows he's not supposed to be outside with her, you kept saying. As if that was the worst of it. Being outside together?" You don't know what it's like out there, I said quietly. You don't know the sorts of people who are out there.
What people?
I looked at his disheveled hair, his heavy eyes fighting the dragging tide of sleep. I said, never mind. Let's go back to sleep.
We did the right thing, Arturo said. She doesn't know what's best. Especially not now.
What does that mean?
A year ago, it would have been different. A year ago, you would have let her be with Mayor like that? A year ago, we weren't here. She wouldn't have known Mayor. But if there had been a Mayor in Mexico, then maybe. I stared at him, piercing holes through the dark.
Why don't you just say what you mean, I asked.
He was quiet.
Say it, Arturo.
Say what?
Say whether you're upset about Mayor and her because she's your daughter, or because she's your brain-damaged daughter.
I never used that word.
Say it, I insisted.
Arturo propped himself up on his elbow and hissed. You don't think I have a right to treat her differently now than I would have before the accident?
You don't think we have the responsibility to do that? She's not the same person, Alma. There's not some piece of her just sitting there waiting for us to find it again. No matter how much schooling or medical care she gets, we can't just put her back together.
I felt something collapse inside of me.
She's getting better, I said.
Arturo peered past my shoulder at Maribel. We shouldn't be having this conversation now.
She was getting better before all of this happened, I said. But even if she gets better from now until eternity, she won't be the same person anymore.
But the doctor said...
The doctor said her brain can heal, but they warned us she would never be the same again.
They didn't say that.
They did, Alma. You just didn't want to hear that part.
She's getting better, I said, as if by repeating it enough, I could somehow make it part of the public record, an indisputable fact.
But don't you understand, Arturo said. We don't get her again.
Across the room, Maribel stirred. I smoothed my hand over the rippled sheet, tears burning in my eyes. Arturo had dropped his head back against the mattress. But I could see that his eyes were open and that he was staring at the ceiling.
The weight of finality. So heavy that it felt like a physical thing hung in the air between us. I didn't want to accept that in order to move forward, I had to walk through it. It was so much easier just to believe there was another path that I could take around it, and that at the end of that path, would be the destination I wanted. It was easier to want to end up at a lie instead of at the truth, which was just as Arturo said. We wouldn't get her again. Not ever.
Mayor. In March, my dad landed a job as a newspaper carrier for the News Journal. He'd gone in because he'd heard that they needed workers on the floor of the press, and after burning through all the restaurants in town, he was getting desperate, even if it meant applying for jobs he was totally unqualified for. He got turned down from the floor job pretty quick, apparently. They asked me three questions. Then the woman who was interviewing me
started shaking her head, saying, "No, I'm sorry. This won't work. We need someone with experience." "Experience," my dad cried, telling my mom and me the story. I told her, "All I know how to do is make breakfast." My mom frowned. "That's not true. You know how to do other things." Then she added, "But only a few." Well, this lady's eyes lit up. "Breakfast?" she said. "Are you a morning person?" Who can tell me what that phrase means? At the diner, customers used to come in all the time and say, "I'm not a morning person." Usually, right before or right after they ordered coffee. But what? The world is divided into morning people and afternoon people and night people? "What did you tell her, Rafa?" I told the lady, "Well, I get up in the morning." My mom laughed. So, the lady asked if I could handle getting up very early. When I said sure, she asked me if I had my own car. Brand new, I told her. She asked, did I have a license and insurance? When I told her yes, she said, "Then I have a job for you." My mom beamed. "This is so exciting! You're a newspaper man now." "It turns out that thing will finally be good for something other than coupons," my dad said. "Will you deliver our newspapers?" my mom asked. "If you're on my route, yes." "I want to be on your route," she said, winking at him. My dad, who looked astonished at first, smiled. He was proud, I think, to know that he'd turned things around, that he'd saved our fortunes, and that he had tugged my mom back over to his side. The turn of events had put my dad in a good enough mood that he ended my grounding, which would have been great, except that I still wasn't allowed to see Maribel, and that was the only thing I really wanted to do. Her parents had started going to a different mass, so I didn't even see her at church anymore. I missed her. Everything about her. But what could I do? Then, as I was sitting in social studies one Friday afternoon, it started snowing. I thought I was imagining it at first. All winter long, I'd been waiting for it to snow. Not for me, but for Maribel, because I knew she wanted to see it. But now that it was March, I had given up on thinking that it would happen. Through the window, I saw a few flakes, all spread out, drifting down as soft as dust. I tapped Jaime de Julio, who sat in front of me. He shrugged me off like a bug had just landed on his shoulder. "Julio," I whispered. He turned around. "I told you not to call me that, Minor." This was his ongoing taunt. Mayor Minor. Hilarious. It's why I'd started referring to him as Julio, even though I knew it was lame revenge. I pointed to the window. He looked, but he must not have seen it. "What's your problem?" he asked. "Snow," I mouthed. He looked again and grinned. "Hell yeah." At the front of the class, Mr. Perry droned on about Amerigo Vespucci and Vasco da Gama and the great age of discovery while I stared out the window. After a while, the snow picked up, falling heavier and steadier. There were 10 minutes left in the period when I raised my hand. "Mayor," Mr. Perry called, "do you have a question?" "Can I use the bathroom?" I asked. He shook his head. "You know the policy." "I can't wait. I really need to go." Mr. Perry frowned. I could see I was getting to him. "Like, bad," I added. Annoyed, Mr. Perry pointed to the hall pass propped up in the chalk tray along the blackboard. I was off before he even had a chance to get back to the lesson. I found William in study hall and convinced him to drive me home. "I thought we were going to a movie today after school," he said. "Change of plans," I told him. I didn't elaborate, and I think the whole way to the apartment, William assumed that the two of us were off on some big adventure together. But when we pulled into the parking lot of my building, I told him I needed him to teach me how to drive stick shift. He looked confused. "I'm taking my dad's car," I said, pointing to where it was parked. "Why? I can drive us wherever we're going."
We are not going anywhere, I said. He stared at me for a second, the dawning of understanding on his face, and then said, yeah. William was awesome, though. After I ran inside and stole the car keys from the windowsill again, the two of us got in my dad's car and took it down to the abandoned auto body shop on the corner, away from where anyone might see us, so that William could give me a crash course in how to drive stick. He walked me through the basics, putting the car in reverse, how to brake, how to shift through the gears, and we drove in circles around the parking lot until finally William said, I think you're good. Really? Good enough, I guess. What if I stall? I asked. No problem. Just start the car again and give the finger to any dickheads honking at you from behind. So that's it? I'm doing this? That's it, young Jedi. Go forth and prosper. You're mixing up your references. William opened the car door and climbed out. He poked his head back in before he closed it. This is about her, isn't it? He asked. I didn't answer. I didn't want to admit it, and William knew anyway. Well, he said, it was nice having you back for a little while at least.